Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Guys have a lot of confidence in themselves. We felt that way going into when we were in training camp and headed into the season. And then when we added Khalil in the trade, you know, he just elevated everybody's play even more. He's a multiplier. And so for our guys, they have no doubt in their minds that they can play well without him. And I think that's pretty special to have.
He's not where he needs to be or where we want him to be. But he's certainly prepared enough to go out there and play if his ankle will let him.
Moline Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score, Friday morning. Lawrence Holmes is in for Mike Mulligan, who's off today. It's a pleasure having Lawrence here to talk a little Bears. And that was the voice of Matt Nagy and then Vic Fangio yesterday at Hallis Hall. And Lawrence, you, every week, your postgame show on NBC Sports Chicago, the football after show.
Yes, the circus.
It is a circus. You are the ringleader.
It's such a great circus.
Lance Briggs, Matt Forte, Alex Brown. And I've been curious to talk to you about this on or off the air because I think it's interesting when you deal with ex-players. And all of us have dealt with ex-players to some degree. People, I think, you have two types. One that is, see no evil, hear no evil. We are part of the team. We are supportive. We are not going to criticize.
Jason Witten.
Okay. Yeah. Then you have guys who maybe go the other way. The extremists. They could be 8-2. And I'm going to see a team that they're never going to be as good as my teammate was. They're never going to be as good as the team that I belong to.
Rodney Harrison.
Okay. They're never going to be that guy. So you know the type. How would you describe the three guys you work with? Because when I watch every week, and sometimes when I haven't been traveled to games, I've been able to see your stuff. And I like that show because of the way that you guys connect and just the content. Where are Lance, Matt Forte, and Alex on the continuum of supportive ex-player over critical ex-player? How would you evaluate their analysis in an objective way?
Well, I think that Alex doesn't mind being the heavy, that he is quick to go, this is not working, or this player is not doing enough, they could do more. But usually it's meant by him to be, I'd want guys to get better. We had a great, great moment last year where Alex had said something about Tariq Cohen. He's like, you know, he can do better. There were something specific. I forget what it was. What was great about it is that the next week Cohen played well and we had him on. And he said, I watched the show and I heard what and it was him watching film.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, I heard what Alex said, and I watched more film this week. Their words carry a lot of weight. Alex Brown, I want to say, is fourth all time in sacks
and that's part of Bears history. And that's part of the reason why I ask you, because this week, you know, we've been talking a lot about, and the writers are writing about, the gulf between the national and local perspective on Mitch Trubisky. You know, there's a big difference of opinion in terms of, and maybe it's just the most polarizing or the loudest people get heard, but when you have a local opinion that's strong one way or another on a quarterback, so it resonates with people. And I think it's probably assumed that it's more informed because we see more of him. And yet sometimes it's better to hear, again, take a step back and to evaluate the 35,000-foot view when you're removed and don't have to worry about that stuff. I guess I'm wondering, where do you think those guys are on Mitch, and how does that affect the way other people interpret what they're watching?
They're not sold 100% on him. And I think what bothers them is while you can look at – I'll give you this statistic. If you look at Mitch's completion percentage overall, you're pretty happy about it. He's completing passes. That's different than being accurate. Ball placement by Mitchell Trubisky has been a little bit troubling at times. Him missing guys that are wide open, that's a struggle. I mean, how many more touchdowns could Taylor Gabriel have this year if Mitch would hit him when he's wide open? So what is valuable to me is those guys not feeling the weight of the city to be like, well, Mitch is the greatest thing that's ever happened. Like, they don't feel that weight. So it allows them, I think, to be honest. I also think that they enjoy being in a position where they can play devil's advocate a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are smart guys. And Alex particularly, like, he understands the platform that he has and that he wants to garner conversation about the team. They never say anything that's not true when it comes to their analysis, but they're not going to bend over backwards to try and make the Bears look good.
You've covered the Bears for a long time, and you've been around the team, I think, as long as I have, and you've seen starts that, you know, people fall in love with ideas and they want to believe things that maybe aren't there. But this year, I think 5-3 feels like 5-3, feels like a first place team. How would you describe the biggest difference? Look, 2013, first year Mark Trestman, I could get you a column that I wrote after the Bears went to 5-3 in Trestman's first year, and a lot of the things that were being said around town sound very similar to what's being said right now. What's the difference to you in the start maybe Trestman had to get off of 5-3 and the one Matt Nagy is?
It doesn't seem like smoke and mirrors to me. Even with Trestman, the way that Nagy can scheme guys open. I'm not fully on board with Mitchell Trubisky yet. I am fully on board with Matt Nagy. I think he's sharp. I think he's smart. And if you look around the rest of the league, it's what guys are doing. So with Trestman, it was kind of like, oh, well, this is interesting what they're doing, and it's kind of avant-garde and all this stuff. What we're seeing Nagy do is what McVay is doing. Honestly, it's what Andy Reid is doing. It's what Doug Peterson is doing.
Okay, but in fairness, and I'm not defending Mark Trestman here, but I think the difference to me is that this defense that Matt Nagy has is ascending.
There's
and
no
he
doubt.
Arrows up. Whereas Mark Trestman inherited a defense that didn't trust him and was on the other way.
And didn't like him.
And didn't like him and was in decline. And a couple guys that you work with, you know very well, they weren't embracing all of the new coach's ideas the way that this defense has embraced theirs. And I think a big part of that for Matt Nagy, his biggest move of all the smart things he's done was making a priority retaining Vic Fangio.
Oh, for sure. Having that, and he even talks about it now, where if you listen to Nagy press conferences, he's pretty much abdicated the defense over to Vic Fangio.
Coach Fangio.
Sure, which is great. It's wonderful for a young coach to have a guy like Vic Fangio. You know what's going to happen with the defense. You know that part of it is taken care of. It also doesn't hurt that you got the best defensive player on the planet in Khalil Mack. That helps. That gives more legitimacy to the idea of balance between offense and defense too. Where with Trestman, it was, you know, Lance was, you know, in his last couple years, like, you didn't have anyone that was ready to kind of take over that mantle from those great Bears teams from before. Where now it's very clear that you have a leader and a great player in Khalil Mack, plus a bunch of young guys that are doing work. We were talking during the break. I don't think that Eddie Jackson is getting enough love locally or nationally. I think that guy is not only playing at a Pro Bowl level, I think that he might be playing at an all-pro level. He's been that good. He has been taking the ball away. He has been making plays. He plays with a confidence that you can only play with if you have a guy like Khalil Mack. And I think that even with Mack out over the last couple of weeks, that confidence is still there. The guys pointed it out to me. Alex and Lance pointed it out that Eddie Jackson believes what he sees. And because of that, it allows him to break on the ball. You're an old safety.
That's what surprised me so much about the way he loafed against the Dolphins. Missed a tackle. Didn't, you know, I think that's a fascinating comment. You're right. He's playing at a high level. But boy, that one play took off, kind of left an impression, the wrong one.
Well, yeah, I get that. And he's
everybody
not,
loafs. Everybody's forgiven one play,
and
one
that
bad
was,
game.
That was bad. Like, that was really bad. But I like that he is so confident in what he sees that he will break on it. And if he's wrong, he's wrong. And Vic will tell him, you know, you can't do that all the time. And this is something that I've been learning, like, even doing the radio show with Lance, is that at some point you will go against scheme – because you have instincts for the game, and they'll allow you to do it as long as you're getting results. And I think Eddie Jackson is getting results. I think that guy has played phenomenally this season.
He's Lawrence Holmes in for Mike Mulligan this morning. Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670. The Score. We'll come back, talk to Sam Peniatovich out in Vegas.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Mullen Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Lawrence Holmes is in this morning for Mike Mulligan, who's got the day off, and somebody who never takes the day off is Sam Peniatovich from VSiN out in Vegas. Good morning, Sam.
Siesta. I hope that's okay. A little siesta.
Okay, a little siesta. That's good. How are you doing this morning?
Hanging out, man. Just looking at this board, trying to make some sense of the Chicago-Detroit line. This is going to be seven, I think, by kickoff, guys. We're going to see a lot more sevens by the time we get closer to kickoff at Soldier Field.
How do you explain the Bears? What do you think people, how much do people believe in them in Vegas? And how important are the next 3 days to kind of reinforce, or next three games in reinforcing that belief?
It's crazy to think this is only their second divisional game, right? I mean, you look at the record, they're 5-3, they're in first place, but at the same time, they've only played one divisional opponent, and that feels like it was a long time ago, right? That was week one in Lambeau against the Packers. The Bears still 0-1 in the NFC North, but as we look at these divisional odds, David, not much has changed over the last couple of weeks. It's been Vikings 1, and it's been Bears 2, but we have seen a lot of divisional drop-offs as far as the odds. So the Vikings now are minus 110, so you have to actually like put down minus money to win. You put 110 to win 100 on Minnesota to win the North. Chicago is up on the odds, plus 160. They were 2-1 last week, so now it's 100 to win 160. But the Packers have been dipped, so have the Lions. Green Bay now 6-1, and the Lions have dropped from 8-1 to 25-1 to win the division. My, how things can change in a week here in the NFL. But we talk about this all the time. Say the Bears lose to the Lions, Bears could be 5-1. The Lions could be back to 10-1. These things change every single week. But the pecking order is still Minnesota, then Chicago, and then Green Bay in the eyes of Vegas.
This segment being brought to you by O'Reilly Auto Parts. Sam, every week I feel like I'm hearing that the Bears line is moved a significant amount. Is that just because we are now becoming more, we're hearing more and more about lines overall in sports radio? Or is that a signal that Bears fans have bought in and they are moving the lines with their belief in the team?
It's not just Bears fans, Lawrence. It's everybody. I mean, they love to bet on this team. You go back the last couple of weeks, I mean, the Bears got over 90% of the bets against the Jets. Then they got almost 90% of the bets against the Bills. They've been a cover team. I mean, the Bears are in the top 10 in the league as far as making you money. So when you walk up to the window, people are confident this year in the defense. And I think everything changed, honestly, and we all know this. Everything changed when they decided Ryan Pace got aggressive, went out and flipped a couple picks for Khalil Mack, because now on paper and on the eye test, you can back a defense that is in every game. And that's the reality here. Players love to bet on teams that have good defenses, that take care of the football. And Chicago, when Chicago's good, people come out of the woodwork to lay their money on a team like the Chicago Bears. It's a very public team, a very popular team. And when they make you money at the window, bettors remember that. Bettors aren't going to walk up and take the Cleveland Browns. They're not going to take the Buffalo Bills. But they've been making money on a team like Chicago. And I think when you look at a team that opened up here -6 in Vegas, right away, Lawrence, it goes to 6.5. And by the time we get the kickoff, this is going to be 7. But I think bookmakers are still waiting for that signature win. Because when you ask these bookmakers out here in Vegas, what's the Bears' best win? There's hesitation. People don't really know what it is. Was it Seattle in week number 2 when they didn't have an offensive line put together? Was it Arizona on the road against Sam Bradford? Was it Tampa? Was it New York? Was it Buffalo? Bookmakers are still waiting for that signature win. But the bettors, to answer your question, they keep lining up to bet on the Bears. And this is the third week in a row when you've seen more and more money and more tickets on the Bears.
Joined by Sam Peniatovich from VSiN out in Vegas on the Mully and Haw Show. Sam, moving to college football, Notre Dame, Ian Book, out this week against Florida State, suffered a rib injury against Northwestern. How does that affect the line, if it does, against a Florida State team that isn't very good? And Notre Dame is much better than just one guy, even though Ian Book has been as important to his offense as anybody.
Only shifted the line by 1 point. only went from 17.5 to 16.5. And when you think about it, you think, Ian Book's probably a couple points better than Brandon Wimbush. But really, when you take a step back, David, I think this is really an indictment of how bad Florida State is. I mean, this team is awful. 4-5 on the season. Willie Taggart can't coach the offense, and that's his job. He's there to put the offense in a position to succeed. But they've been outscored in their last two games, 106-38. They gave up 500 against Clemson. They only had 17 first downs against NC State. So I think it's less how important is Ian Book to the line and more how bad is Florida State and will they show up? Because, you know, it seems like that, if they're down early and the other team can smell blood, this could be a blowout. I mean, look at what happened when Clemson went into Tallahassee. 59-10. How does that happen if you're Florida State? How does that happen? The line, I thought it would move a little bit more. I thought he was probably worth like 2.5 points to the line. But when he was ruled out with that rib injury, it went from 17.5 to 16.5. And that's where it hangs out right now. It hasn't really budged. I thought there'd be more people rushing into the window to take Florida State. But you just can't get anybody to sharpen their knife on Florida State because nobody thinks they're good and nobody thinks they're for real. So only a point drop-off between Book and Wimbush, which when you think about it, it doesn't sound like it's that big of a deal.
Sam, Alabama's clearly the best team in college football. But how can a fan make money off of Alabama? Because everyone knows that they're the best team in college football.
That's a great question. I've been asked pretty much every week here. I do all these things across the country and everything. And, well, should I bet against Alabama this week? And should I maybe go against them in the first half? And I keep saying, well, what's the point? They've covered every single game in the first half. So they've played 9 games. They're 9-0 in the first half. And, Lawrence, it's crazy because say the game line is 14 like it was last week against LSU. Your first half line is like 9, 9.5, and it doesn't matter. They're up 16-0 at the half. They're up early every single game. And people keep saying, well, this is the week. This is the week. We're almost out of weeks. I mean, we only got a couple left with Alabama. So I don't know what the point is to bet against them in the first half and what the point is to bet against them. I mean, they're just so damn good. And oddsmakers have told me that. So, for example, they power rate these teams, the line makers, and 100, just 100 even. That's a good football team. Alabama's power rating this year is 145. That's the highest that anybody has ever had on any team in the history of college football going back on these power ratings. So Alabama at 145, your next best team is Clemson. And Clemson's a really good football team this year. They're 137. But Alabama, again, on a scale of 100, they're 145. So I have no reason to, because they have a quarterback that can score in a heartbeat. They have a defense that's getting better every week. And when that nut job, Nick Saban, when he has time to prepare for you, there's no reason to go against them. I get the question. I get the logistics of the question. But you haven't been making money betting against Alabama, especially this year.
Sam, before we let you go, what are your favorite plays this week? And how much are you allowing your head to rule your heart when you're talking about the Northwestern game?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've only picked against Northwestern one time this year. That was against Duke. And you guys keep me straight on this. I am taking the Iowa Hawkeyes. So I just think when you look at the spread and the line opens up at 10 and you're like, wow, Northwestern's in first place and I can get 10? I'll pocket that. It's never that easy. Iowa goes back home. They're 4-1 against the number at Kinnick this year. They've been really, really good at home. They have 2 losses in a row. They're going to get right at home. So I laid the points with Iowa. I also grabbed the 20 with Boston College. This is a night game in Chestnut Hill. Let's see what Trevor Lawrence can do in prime time, baby. I mean, he's done it in a lot of afternoon spots against a lot of bad teams.
Tough place to
now
play.
Now you got to go in. Yeah. I'm taking the 20 with Boston College, and you guys may hang up on me, but I took 7 with the Detroit Lions. I think the Bears win this game, but I think it's 21-20, 24-23. Could go to overtime, and if that's the case, if I have 7, I'm not losing. I took the 7 with the Detroit Lions.
We're not hanging up on you, but you have to say goodbye, Sam. Have a great weekend, and good luck with your picks.
You guys too. Take care.
Sam Paniatovic from VSiN out in Vegas. Going with the Lions, Joe. What do you think?
Yeah, I like that. 7 points. Just the history of these two teams just playing tight here. I like the 7, but I think the Bears do pull away with the victory. If not, it'll be an interesting Monday.
You shouldn't treat people that way.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Kane wants gets it. He's got it. He's got some speed into the zone. Patrick Kane is Texas. He's ready to shoot. The Canes get it out, and the Carolina Hurricanes have snapped a five-game slide.
It's important that got to believe in what we're doing. We just the message we sent was similar to what I just said. We give them a lot of their momentum. We give them a lot of their opportunities because we were unclean with the puck, and in defensive zone, we were a little bit loose.
Molly and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Lawrence Holmes in this morning for Mike Mulligan, and that was the voice of first Pat Foley from NBC Sports Chicago after last night's Blackhawks loss to the Carolina Hurricanes 4-3. And then you heard from new Hawks coach Jeremy Culleton, who was coaching in his first game at the United Center. Kind of an awkward moment for everybody, but he is the future, and he's here now. And Charlie Romeliotis from NBC Sports Chicago was there last night, and he's covered this story all week. Good morning, Charlie. How are you?
Good. Not too bad on this early Friday snowy morning in Chicago.
Thanks for getting up early. You were there last night. I guess before the game, it surprised me they did not introduce Jeremy Culleton. They did not acknowledge him necessarily. Do you know why? And were you surprised, and how would you describe the atmosphere?
Yeah, I'm guessing they were just going to eliminate some awkwardness of the introduction and maybe the smattering of boos that you probably would have heard, not necessarily towards Jeremy, but maybe towards the decision to fire head coach Joel Quenneville. It was a little bit of an awkward feeling, obviously, because people didn't really know how to react because there were a lot of unhappy fans after the decision. So I would say the first period itself was really awkward because they didn't know whether to get up for the game or if they should still be protesting the move in a sense.
So, Charlie, what are we going to notice is different with Culleton from Q? Is there anything in the first few weeks you're looking for as far as line consistency or anything like that that might be different from what we saw from Quenneville?
Yeah, Jeremy said he kind of plays a similar style to what Joel Quenneville plays. Just some tweaks in maybe in the defensive zone and maybe in the offensive zone as well. But the theme is the same. Now, what I'm really going to be looking forward to is the power play, because the second Jeremy walked into those doors, one of the first things he's been working on is the power play, and particularly the entries. The morning skate usually starts officially at 10:30 for the Blackhawks, and he had them out 20 minutes early. And the first thing they were working on was power play for those first 15 or 20 minutes before morning skate started. So that's an area he's taking full control of, and he certainly wants to get right because it's been a disaster for the Blackhawks for 2 years now.
Joined by Charlie Romeliotis from NBC Sports Chicago, covers the Blackhawks. Charlie, last night postgame, how would you describe the way that he handled that? What did he say that stood out, if anything? And was he fazed by coaching in his first NHL game?
No, he wasn't. I think it was, I think it would have been much worse if that route ended up staying, 4-0 or whatever going forward. But we talked to Patrick Kane after the game, and he said, Jeremy had a powerful message in between the first and second periods, and not necessarily this rah-rah speech and saying, like, we got to get going here, but it was just very calm. It was just, these are self-inflicted wounds here, and it's a good thing because these are correctable issues if we're the ones beating ourselves. So I think in that sense, he's been a calm presence behind the bench. He was a calm presence in the locker room, and maybe he'll do some more talking inside the locker room. Joel usually didn't do that in between periods. It was usually the players, but I just think he could be a calming presence behind the bench here going forward.
I know what the Blackhawks said about the change. I'm curious, as someone who's around the team as much as you are, what you think about why it happened, when it happened, and what it means.
Yeah, it's hard because last year it was fair to bring back Joel and Stan in a sense that there was no Corey Crawford for the second half of the year, and they missed Marian Hossa unexpectedly due to his skin allergy, and a lot of things went wrong last year that you felt that they both deserved a second shot. But at the same time, it was such a quick hook after 15 games, and I think it was made because the Blackhawks don't want to give up on this season. And because they're in the Central Division in the Western Conference, where if you go down a few points, like they had a five-game losing streak, and I don't think that was the reason why they fired head coach Joe Quenneville. I think it was because the inconsistencies were there and the issues were there from last year before Corey got hurt. It was giving up those high-quality scoring chances, the power play, the top guys weren't performing. Just a lot of things went wrong, and I think they just want to completely get out in front of it and avoid that. Now, you could argue, you know, maybe the Blackhawks were looking for a reason to do it, and they didn't. Last offseason maybe wasn't the most fair for anyone. But, you know, I think in a sense they try to get out in front of it because they still don't want to pack in this season. They still want to try to make a push here.
Charlie Romeliotis joins us from NBC Sports Chicago on Mullen Haw this morning. Lawrence Holmes in for Mike Mulligan. Charlie, you asked a good question of Eddie Olczyk last night on Sports Talk Live. I thought Eddie was 38 years old when he took over the Pittsburgh Penguins, and he had to deal with a lot of, you know, a young coach, first-time head coach, dealing with veterans who may or may not have accepted him right away. How do you think the Hawks veterans will accept or have accepted a 33-year-old head coach after playing for a Hall of Fame coach for 10 years? I mean, he's younger than Duncan Keith. He's younger than four players. He played youth hockey with Brent Seabrook as a teammate. This has got to be a weird dynamic.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure it is. But, you know, at Wednesday's practice, when Jeremy was kind of in full control of the practice, I was kind of observing how the players were being receptive to Jeremy. And they were all eyes and ears. And I think you have to be early on, especially when you have a new coach, no matter the age. You know, Patrick Kane was saying when he's up there on the drawing board, you're not thinking about his age. You're just thinking about what he's saying and what he's preaching and how you're going to adapt to his system. And I think he's so mature where everyone around the locker room just says he's a very bright hockey mind and he's a good communicator. So I think that's the most important thing. And if you can win over the veterans, like Patrick Kane played his 28 minutes the other night. That's how you win over your veterans and you put those trusts in those players. And I think that once the veterans do completely buy in, it's going to trickle down up and down the roster.
Okay. So here's my question about the Blackhawks overall, Charlie. Do they have enough talent to be competitive this year? And what I mean by competitive is not just making the playoffs, but scaring people. And do they need to address the issue of when Corey Crawford's not in net, they don't win?
Yeah, right now it's hard to say this is a playoff roster, especially with what's going on in the Central Division. Like, you're going to need to – like, you can't go on a three-game losing streak here or whatever. I think it's going to be interesting to see how this roster responds when they're maybe fully healthy, when they have one of their top prospects like Dylan Sakura come up here, when Connor Murphy gets healthy and he's back into the fold, when Gustav Forsman gets healthy and he's back on the blue line. Like, how is this all going to look when they're all playing together? And then maybe Stan Bowman can say, okay, this is what we have. This is what we need at the trade deadline. Maybe they go out and get a top nine forward, or maybe they go out and try to get a top four defenseman that also fits in the long-term plan. But it's hard to look at the roster right now and say, okay, you know, this is, maybe the coaching change was the problem. Like, they still need it. The roster construction is still not where it needs to be. That Jeremy needs help eventually. If playoffs are the goal, then you're certainly going to have to add some pieces to this puzzle. But as it stands right now, I don't think it is a playoff team because they're so dependent on Corey Crawford.
I don't disagree with that. And I think, though, if you get the players that you're talking about, that those are going to require trades of veterans. And I think when you bring up the coach from Rockford, the assumption is you're going to bring up kids and prospects. Those two thoughts aren't necessarily compatible, and I think that's going to be where the conflict arises for this Hawks season. It's going to make it kind of an uneven year.
Right, and the Blackhawks have kind of taken these last 2 years to refill that pipeline. So if you make any trade, you're going to go have to dip into the Rockford pool, and you're going to have to trade part ways with maybe a player that you weren't. You know, like, if you want to make a trade, like, the Blackhawks aren't going to go out and get a rental forward for this season. They're going to go out and get someone that makes sense for now and the future. So in that sense, like, they're not going to go out and give up draft picks and first rounders like they have in the past just to kind of go all in on this season. And that's where it's going to get tricky because you know, the Blackhawks say that it's a remodeling period and they want to compete this year, but at the same time, they don't want to sacrifice the long term for it. So it's a little bit of a dicey situation.
I would imagine that you are getting more feedback from Blackhawks faithful than we are. What has been the feedback throughout this week? How have Blackhawks fans felt about the goings on at 1901?
I think it's still a little fresh, the Joel Quenneville news. And yesterday it was a little bit awkward feeling in the United Center because, you know, it obviously wasn't received well among the fan base. But I also think there is some excitement for Jeremy. It's just too early right now because the wound is so fresh. And I think at some point, once all that awkwardness goes away, Chicago fans will get to see what the Blackhawks can accomplish under Jeremy Colliton.
Good stuff, Charlie. Charlie rolling me out. Otis from the NBC Sports Chicago covers the Blackhawks. Appreciate you getting up for us.
Thanks, guys.
Lawrence, we've had so far Charlie's Romeo Otis, Sam Paniatovich. We've got Joe Fortenbaugh and Gordon Whittemeyer to come. It's like we're playing Scrabble this morning.
I enjoy that I am not driving today.
That's Lawrence Holmes in for Mike Mulligan. We come back. It's Biggs time on Molly and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.